Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration. Collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with Charles Plant. He is a guy who's kind of hard to pin down. In some ways, well, he self-proclaimed sufferer from shiny ball syndrome, and he's going to talk about that. We're going to talk a lot about entrepreneurship and about innovation and about best practices and where this whole world is heading and where it isn't heading. He is referred to also sometimes as a serial entrepreneur. His website, materialminds.com, you'll have to check it out and learn a little bit more about him. But he's had an incredibly fascinating past, and we have this really, in a way, I guess we have a shiny ball conversation, but we cover a lot of ground, and I think we plant a lot of seeds. We talk about technology and about why businesses fail. We talk a little bit about Charles's past and what the idea of a trigger is all about, and what that means with respect to getting an idea and turning it into something that's actually going to become a business and truly innovate and maybe even change the world. So stay tuned with a really interesting, fun interview with Charles Plant. You're going to love it. You're going to enjoy it on a whole lot of levels. And like I said, it's going to plant some seeds and peel back a few layers for you with regard to a whole lot of things. DavidPeckLive.com, coming soon to a theater near you. Check it out for a whole lot of other interviews under Face to Face. And get a copy of my new book, Real Change is Incremental. Stay tuned. Charles Plant. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today. Charles Plant is here with us today.
You say that to all your guests, don't you?
Well, you know what? Sadly, I do. We're moving up on 200 guests here, Charles, and everyone's been a very special guest.
Good. Yes,
but you're extra special.
Thanks.
Thanks for saying yes and for joining us today. And interestingly, this actually is face to face. This interview. Typically, even ironically, a lot of my interviews are over the phone or Skype. So I'm glad to be sitting here with you in Toronto. Kind of a gray day out there, and I'm not sure what to make of that. But anyway, thanks.
Gray and getting warm and muggy.
Oh, yes, lovely. Sounds like the weekend must be coming. Yes. So Charles is a... I'm going to let him tell you more about what he is and what he does and who he is, but he's a serial entrepreneur, which already raises questions for me. But you're also a researcher. You've taught at York University, Schulich School of Business, U of T. It sounds like you're kind of into a whole lot of things. A lot of people say to me, Charles, that I've got a lot of irons in the fire. I think you're pushing out most of my irons by the sounds of it.
Well, I'm easily bored.
You're easily bored.
Suffer from shiny ball syndrome, so anything that's going to entertain me, I'll do.
So do you have ADD?
Probably, but
should
you
know, this be therapy, really?
I'm at the age where they didn't diagnose. I don't think they'd heard of ADD when I was in school, so...
Yes.
Yeah, that might have been.
Yeah, and do you medicate
diagnosis
with Grey Goose? That's the question.
With exercise.
Exercise.
Exactly.
Nice.
It tries to calm me down.
There you go. What's shiny ball syndrome for you? I mean, it's...
You know, I just love learning things.
Mm.
And so I tend not to like to do things twice. So after I've done it once, I don't want to particularly do it again, so I look for something else to do. And so I wander from thing to thing, being entertained and getting a different perspective. It all sort of focuses in on one, let's say, core theme, which is the technology industry.
Right, okay.
So I've spent my life in the technology industry in every particular way that you can spend it, as an entrepreneur, as an employee, as an investor, investment banker. I've worked in venture capital. I've taught it. I've researched it. So, you know, I'm just keep looking at the same industry. And what's fascinated me over time is, what's it take to be successful? How do we define success, and what do you have to do to be successful? So that probably over the last 15 years has been a big focus for me, is researching what it takes to be successful with a background of actually having done it, and done it badly sometimes and done it well other times.
I'd love to talk about that whole idea of success, and even in your own life, I'd love to. It's interesting that you're researching that, and is that shiny ball syndrome have anything to do with you feeling like maybe you haven't been successful yet? Like you've got this hill to climb and you're still pushing the rock up it, and eventually you'll go, yep, capital S success, I've made it.
No, it's a good question. I mean, to define what success is, because most of the world defines it in terms of, in monetary
terms.
Usually,
right?
Yeah.
Usually.
But that's, there's always somebody more successful unless you're Bill Gates.
It's got to be kind of empty on some level, I think.
And then also, if you don't like buying things, because I'd rather have experiences than things, that, you know, what's the use of money? There's only so much you can experience, and you travel the world and do whatever you want.
Yeah,
and so, you know, collecting money seems like a fruitless thing to spend your time doing. So, no, I don't really understand myself what I would define success as. And that's not what I'm looking at. And, you know, I try to look at other people's perspective and say, okay, if you define success in this way, then what can you do to create that type of success? And what do you have to do? And what's the research
say? Well, the question
say?
I have with the whole success thing is, and I've struggled with it as an entertainer, as a guy now who is an entrepreneur, and or at least I think I am, and trying to build my own business and working this whole field of social change and international development, and struggling. It's tough, right? Mm-hmm. You're a party of one often. You're selling, you're consulting, you're implementing, you're reporting. I just got audited. It's exhausting, right? So, but at what point do I say, is 85 grand a year enough for me with two employees making around the same? I have my original idea, mm-hmm. you know, for the budget I wanted SoChange to be at, and three employees and a little office space. Haven't got there yet. But at the same time, I've done some pretty cool things, pretty mm-hmm. interesting things. Seeds have been planted. I've made some money along the way. So, yeah, it's a tough one, because I think the whole success thing can probably drive you mad on one level, but also can really motivate you on another.
It can. It can make you focus.
Right.
And maybe that's why I've never been able to focus, because I never had a good definition of what success is. That, you
right.
know, anything that I do seems to be fun and interesting, so I'll just keep doing the fun and interesting things.
So when you say you don't like to do something a second time, does that mean you do it long enough to get good at it and then move on?
Long enough to get bad at it. Probably. No, I'm more of an 80%er. You know,
okay.
I could care less about getting to 100%. I learn enough that I can be effective.
So Gladwell would say you put in 8,200 hours?
Something like that. And then go, okay, that's enough.
That's right.
I don't need to learn anymore. You know, and I first discovered that by huge mistake, I became a banker.
Hmm.
You know, I started out as a chartered accountant, which was mistake number one. MBA in marketing, which was a good move, but then I thought I'd combine the two in banking. But I realized I spent a year in banking, and I learned all I needed to know about banking. And from then on, I said, you know, if I don't like it, I'm not going to repeat it. And so, you know, you can have 10 years of experience or 1 year of experience 10 times.
Mm.
And I'm looking more at 10 years
of
experience.
You know, I have a friend, Eden Rahim, actually. He works in Toronto at a hedge fund. And he said to me many times that he tells, not that he mentors a lot of people, but students, you know, there are programs out there that can tell you these things about banking and about the financial world and mm-hmm. so on. And so Eden chose to study philosophy alongside of another discipline outside of the financial world. And here he is today managing a hedge fund. I mean, how cool and interesting is that? And I wonder if there's something there for you on a relational level. You know, did you just tap into something there? I learned everything I needed to know in a year, and I needed, other subtleties, other nuances to keep my interest.
Yeah, if success, I think, comes, and we're back on this issue of success,
sure.
from doing the same thing over and over and over and over again, time and time again, and doing a bit more every year. So it isn't typical that you become successful by doing something different every year. If you look at the people who are phenomenally successful, they have a path that started really early added and added and added to it.
And don't you think, though, that, and you're doing research in this now at U of T and on innovation and entrepreneurship and so on, and clearly a very eclectic background. I mean, your network must be huge, your level of experience. I just think of the narrative that you must have, the stories, the arc. Isn't there something to be said for, I think sometimes we sell ourselves short, this idea that we have to focus on one thing. I think, and I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, yes, okay, you can become an expert in earthworms.
Sounds exciting.
I know, but I guess there are people who spend their lives studying earthworms. Yeah. And listen, I'm really glad they do. But at the same time, I wonder if they could also maybe have learned a heck of a lot about chess and wine and cooking and relationships. And maybe they do. Maybe I haven't done my research. But I hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, Peck, you got to focus on this one thing to get really good at it. And I'm not convinced.
Well, I think you have to focus on one thing to make a lot of money. You might not have to get good at it to make a lot of money. You just have to focus in on it. And if you look and you said network and how many people if you keep telling the story year after year and it's the same story, you're going to keep meeting more and more people. And you have to tell somebody 7 times before they'll listen to you. And you have to tell 1,000 people to capture 20 of them. So it becomes a large process of just doing it again and again. So if you're suffer from shiny ball syndrome and you get bored doing things, you don't get that type of success. So, it's more of a personal success than having done many different things.
Do you deal with people the same way? Do you find the shiny ball syndrome bleeds off into your relational world? So do you get bored with people quickly?
No, that's funny because I've got a group of friends that I've been good friends with for over 40 years.
Oh, okay.
And I still see them. I go on vacations with them. I see them on a regular basis. So, no, in fact, that it is a very rock solid group of friends that I've had for a very long time.
Which, back to the whole, maybe we're this podcast is going to end up being about success, but I mean, I think successful people are surrounded by a circle of people, a core group of people that they call friends, that are confidants, that are mentors, and so on.
Well, the interesting thing about my group of friends is they're all very outdoor athletically oriented. And scratch their heads when I start talking about the world of technology.
Mm.
So the two worlds just do not meet.
Right. So tell me more about this world of technology and where we're heading. Like what are you seeing? I mean, how come we're not wearing rocket packs yet? That's I think that might be the fundamental question, right?
Yeah,
they lied to me.
Exactly, the Jetsons. Where are they now?
They lied to me.
No, but I was getting frustrated last night with my iPad because it's slow.
Yes, I would agree.
And then
my line is every time I get cut off with one. I was on a phone last night with a guy, cell phone 3-4 times, and he kept talking about David, you're clearly patient calling me back. There's all these spots on the highway, and I go, they're going to be great one day when they get them figured out.
Yeah.
Right, and it's my line now because it happens all the time.
Yeah. But you think back 20 years, and there was no access to information. We've become spoiled. So we do have rocket packs, but they're mental rocket packs.
Mm.
We've got information up the wazoo and don't know what to do with it. We're inundated and overwhelmed with information. So in one way, we haven't figured out how to get from Toronto to Montreal in an hour, but we've figured out how to know everything we can possibly know about Montreal without going there.
Do you think the future is going to be about... and maybe that's where technology is heading, is helping us filter? Or is that going to really only ever be a relational kind of intentionality that we all have to come to terms with? The ubiquity of the internet, the access to information, it's all there, right? The distraction of it.
Yeah, I'm not much of a futurist. I scratch my head wondering what's going to happen in the future and all the trends that I've been part of, but haven't really noticed them as trends, maybe because I've been in them too early or something like that. But you mentioned a good thing about the ubiquity of information. People don't want information.
Mm.
And we were talking about that a little earlier, and the knowledge economy and thought leadership and things like that, is that what's resonating with people is not fundamentally the information that's out there. It's what's resonating is clickbait. People get an emotional connection from what they're consuming in terms of any form of internet consumption, and that's what matters now, not the information.
Clickbait being an ad on a Facebook page or somewhere that on an internet page that's not related to what I actually went there for.
Oh yeah, it's right. 10 celebrities that look terrible now.
right, I was on that 10 last night.
10 child stars that have heroin right. addictions.
Right.
Yeah, that's yes. the sort of thing. You know, yes. they make us feel better about ourselves. And that's the emotional reaction that our people are having. And they're passing by this the knowledge and intellect on the way to forming an emotional connection.
Do you think that's fulfilling a need? Or is that really purely a distraction?
No, it makes people feel good. And I think that's a need. And, if you look at social media and the way people interact on social media and what triggers their interest and what triggers their response, it's a very strong emotional connection. And, I hesitate to say that people don't used to have it and don't have it anymore, so they're craving it. I think they just crave it all the time and are now have the opportunity to experience it in more facets.
Okay, the risk of going a little too deep, and I don't think it is really that deep, but...
We won't get into Schopenhauer here, I promise.
No, okay, excellent. Is there a desire for intimacy there? Is there a desire for that circle of friends, that group of people that a lot of folks don't have? Therefore, clickbait is so popular. I mean, it's connecting on some level, as you say, emotionally, narratively.
Well, I'm not sure that intimacy is the right word, but the emotional connection with stars is very important.
Stars, as in celebrities.
Celebrities, yeah. And celebrities who are very effective at creating that emotional connection. Kardashians. Mm-hmm. What on earth?
I said to Elizabeth, my wife, a couple nights ago, there was a piece, I think, on the Trevor Noah show, the Daily Show. I honestly don't get it. Yeah. I don't even know where they came from. I couldn't give you a history.
We don't get it because we've been disintermediated. We of the so-called thought leadership, intellectual elite, educated, small percentage of the population have been bypassed by this Kardashian effect, which doesn't appeal to us, and we don't understand it because it's not meant for us. It's the Occupy movement on social media. It's who care? I don't care what you're thinking anymore. I care about what Kim Kardashian's wearing.
Do I need to be concerned about this as a parent?
I was a parent. Although, my kids are so old now that I don't even think about things like that.
Yeah, yeah. You hear about it a lot. I'm telling you. I mean, you don't have to go too far to get into a conversation with a parent about the internet.
Yeah.
Period. Yeah. And that's not just a reference to, the nastiness of the internet, but it's just. Yeah, it's about access, I guess. It's about the ubiquity of it, it seems to me, anyway, the immediacy.
Yeah, I wouldn't think you'd be concerned about it. I think it's actually a good thing. I happen to think gossip is a great thing, because gossip is a way that society regulates its own behavior. You learn about, when you gossip, you learn about what other people think of certain different types of behavior. And so that's a lot of what's happening on the internet now, is you're learning about other people's behavior and the reaction that our other people are having to that behavior. So instead of the small town environment, which many people grew up in without the internet years ago, and your behavior being moderated by people that you knew in the town telling you to behave that way or not to behave that way, it's now happening through social media, and you can see what people do and the disapproval they get and the approval they get, and that is moderating people's behavior. So if you're worried about the messages that they're getting because you don't like those messages, that might be of concern. But I think people are normally level-headed, and so they're not. It can be a force for good.
You didn't go to Rexdale Public School.
I didn't, you know.
this notion about gossip being a way a society regulates itself sounded like something Christopher Hitchens would have said, or Noam Chomsky.
Like Noam Chomsky better, because he seems like a much nicer person. Yeah, Christopher Hitchens is a polemicist of the highest order, so I'll sit and berate everybody as I say it.
It's kind of true, isn't it? It's too bad, because I think he was a brilliant man.
Yeah.
But you're right, he always seemed to have issues.
A little too angry.
Very angry. And I don't know about you, but I just love watching Chomsky. I can watch him talk about anything.
Totally.
My favorite line of Chomsky's is, it's in the literature. So, you know, in other words, smarten up and go and read a few books. It's in the literature. You can check the literature. So how do you, it sounds to me like you've been innovating for years. You've been turning corners. You've been climbing hills. You've been, create milestones. We can use all the language we want.
New products, new companies, always trying something new.
You became a banker. You were CFO at Mars, for heaven's sakes.
That was a mistake, too.
Funny. But still, really largely innovative in a sense. I mean, you didn't start out as that. It wasn't something you really wanted. Right.
Which, but the Mars or the
CEO? The Mars thing, by the sounds of it.
No, that one wasn't. The problem is, once you're a chartered accountant and background in finance, people look around and go, oh, you can do that.
Right.
You get dragged back into something because the people of that ilk are in high demand. And so, I've struggled to keep away from it, and every now and then I slip back into something I know I don't enjoy. But
So how, after all these years, and I don't know how many that is, and you don't have to tell us, but you've got older kids. I did catch that. How do you define innovation?
Oh, well, classically, it's a new idea that reaches the marketplace. So, and I say idea.
Sounds very Wikipedia-ish.
Yeah, I know. It can be in the form of a product or a movement or something. But it doesn't work unless it's accepted in the marketplace. So there's the two aspects of it's new and it gets into the marketplace somehow. Podcasts, good example. That we were talking about earlier, or innovation that's been successful in the marketplace.
What about just ideas? Can you innovate on a relational level, can't you? You can innovate in a marriage. You can innovate with your family. It's not just about selling a product, right? It's not just about a business venture, although it seems like that's what we mean, or maybe pharmaceutical companies, or an advance in the car. We're looking at a new car, and holy cow, have they ever turned up the volume on the gadget side of things? It's cool. It's awesome. little flashlights that are in the trunk now that you have, it's just amazing stuff. And you go, wow, what a great idea. I wish I thought of it.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest forms of innovation comes in new ideas, and you can almost look now and see the ideas that are being accepted by society that would have been totally unacceptable a number of years ago. And you can look to the United States and compare the ideas that are successful in Canada that are not succeeding in the United States and are successful in some parts of the states and not in others. And you can actually track the acceptance of ideas through a population in the same way that you track the acceptance of a new product innovation through a marketplace. And it takes about a generation. And you sort of say, well, that's odd, because Facebook was accepted much faster than 30 years. But when it comes right down to it, Facebook is a real outlier. It's not just a unicorn. It's way up there, and it's the unicorn of all unicorns, and has reached tremendous penetration in the marketplace very quickly. But if you look at cell phones, which are still growing in acceptance, I had my first cell phone in the mid-80s. So we are 30 years into the cell phone marketplace. And it's still a growing business worldwide. So ideas are the same way. Look at acceptance of marijuana. I don't know what age you are, but it was certainly accepted by my generation at a very young age. Mm-hmm. But it's taken my generation to become the old age to get over the hurdle of being widely accepted.
And also still not accepted in a lot of places and by a lot of people.
Exactly.
And may never be.
It'll take a while.
You look at, how about political, right? And right now it's just perfect timing to make fun of what's going on politically pretty much around the world, it seems to me. But you don't have to look too far south to say, this is a game show, isn't it? And we're going to wake up and somebody's going to go, ha ha, I had you all along. And I keep waiting for that, but it doesn't seem like that's coming. So the flip side of that is the lack of innovation, the inability to see. I'm fascinated as a social change guy, as a philosopher and teacher and so on, and a guy who tries to plant seeds. Yeah. I want to plant a seed with you for change that I know that maybe if it's nurtured well and watered, it's going to grow into something else. What is it that takes you to the next, to the next level that gets you outside of your framework? You know, I had a gender specialist speaking in my class yesterday, and I asked her in front of the class, how do you put on a new lens? How do you do that? And maybe it takes a generation.
Well, I study this with regard to product acceptance. And when you look at it, there's something fundamental that has to be there to move people towards a new idea or a new product, and that's a trigger. And you look at products that have failed in the marketplace, like Google Glass, that came out to great fanfare, and a few people bought it, and then it just absolutely went back in the cupboard. Fundamentally, there was no trigger that said to people, yeah, that's something I have to have. And I think as you look at social change, that same concept of a trigger has to exist. And the acceptance of something comes from a reference to somebody else who's accepted it, whose opinion think is a valid opinion. So as you look through, and this comes back to the problem of thought leadership and emotional leadership, is that the intelligentsia might accept something, but that doesn't translate to the people who aren't affected by logical decisions or more affected by emotions. So I know I'm rambling here a little, but there's something that has to move ideas through a population that is more and more reluctant to accept new ideas, particularly with age and socioeconomic factors. If you look at Crossing the Chasm, which is Geoffrey Moore's classic book on how technology gets accepted, it's the same thing with ideas. Ideas have to cross the chasm. They have to meet some need, some trigger in the so-called pragmatists to get out of the hands of, let's call them the intelligentsia, and into the mainstream of the market.
It's fascinating to me that the fair trade market existed in Wilberforce's day. That you could get fair trade sugar, that there were groups of women in the UK that were saying, this is wrong the way we're treating people who farm sugar mm-hmm. and sugar cane, and we've got to change that. Mm-hmm. That's what, 120 years ago? Yes, quite a while ago.
Yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say the whole fair trade sugar movement hasn't really panned out in maybe the way they were hoping,
yeah.
And yet fair trade is definitely seems to have taken, and yet it represents a very small percentage of, say, the coffee market, for instance. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 120 years of thinking and thought,
So forget the people who really, if you look at Geoffrey Moore's Crossing the Chasm, the technology enthusiasts and the visionaries, they can accept these new ideas like fair trade.
Yes.
But what's going to get the average person to accept a new idea when they're getting anybody to change is really, really difficult.
Yes.
Look at smoking. People have known since the 50s that smoking is bad for you, but still 20% of the population smokes.
Yeah.
Those people need to be triggered somehow.
Hand washing is another goodie.
Yeah.
That's another good example.
A trigger comes because something's changed in your life, and that change in your life means that you have to see things with a new lens. You have a new set of needs, new set of requirements. Triggers happen when people go to school or leave school, when they get married, when they have a family, when they have... a new job. These are natural triggers that occur. In companies, they occur when the company has to scale or the technology's changed or something like that. So, even with ideas, people have to be triggered into the acceptance of the ideas.
I love what you said earlier. I would love to go down this path for a second, and then I want to come back to your comments about thought leadership and versus emotional, or the thought versus the mm-hmm. emotional. Because I think there's something really interesting there, but also a great insight about how I don't think many of us are logical at all. I think most of what we do is emotional, mm-hmm. it seems to me. You said that, the triggers often can come through, especially with social change and maybe with product, a group of people that have also sort of accepted that within your circle of reference,
yeah,
I guess, or yep. circle of influence, perhaps, yep. maybe. To me, that's an argument for being optimistic. To me, that's an argument for saying change is possible, because I don't know when, where, and if I'm going to maybe potentially affect somebody else's thinking in a way and shift them and actually act as that trigger effect to take them to the next. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but there's another factor here, and that's the barriers to change. People don't like to change, and
no,
there are risks to deal with change. There are learning costs, there are implementation costs. The biggest barrier is what is called the endowment effect, and when you own something, it's part of your endowment. This is why hoarders hoard. You know, they see that everything they own is part of them, and they're reluctant to part with it because they feel they're losing part of themselves. So to get someone to accept a new idea, they have to lose an idea that they currently have.
Right.
And if they identify themselves with that idea or with that group of people, then they don't perceive the value of the new idea alone. They perceive the new idea as adding value, but they see a loss in the old idea. And people hold to these old ideas because it's part of them. It's how they define themselves. I'm a Maple Leafs fan. Well, you move to Vancouver, you're going to become a Vancouver fan? Probably not, just because it's part of your being that you're a Maple Leafs fan, sadly enough.
So basically, the barriers to moving forward have to do with our own deep insecurities. Is that another way of looking at it?
You know, you're married.
Yep.
Have you tried to change your spouse? How's that worked?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how's that working out for you?
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, you can't change the people that are closest to you. And then look at the things that you might have done to try and change yourself. You know, people say, I'm a procrastinator. I want to change. People don't change. You know, it's a really, really difficult thing for an individual who is really motivated to actually change.
And yet, as an innovator, you have to, on some level, believe in systemic change.
No, as an innovator, what you have to do is find what the triggers are and build ideas and products around existing triggers and not try and trigger people to change because you don't have enough money to do it.
Interesting.
You've got to find the receptiveness to something, an idea, if you're working in the world of social change. Find what's going to trigger people.
So people will change. It's just going to be really hard.
Yeah.
You've got to continue to focus on those triggers, find out what they are, which requires all kinds of, research and analysis. And frankly, I mean, for me, and people are going to get sick of hearing this on my podcast on Face to Face, but I continue to talk about this idea of listening. And I wonder if to be a good innovator, to be an entrepreneur, if you have to listen. And it sounds to me like you do. And for me, it's about meditating, it's about focusing and trying to live in the moment and being present with others and all those things. But as a development guy, as a social change guy, if you're not listening to the culture that you're working in, you're kind of screwed, right?
Yeah, totally.
And sadly, I think... Yeah.
But it's one step more than listening. It's asking all sorts of questions. People are really bad at asking questions. When you come right down to it, well, you're a professional question asker, so you're pretty good at it, but... Most people you meet, cocktail party or something, they don't ask you about yourself. They aren't asking questions, so they're not listening, they're not learning. And, you know, that's the way most people act.
It's interesting.
Very difficult to move them towards that. So, you know, if you want to affect social change, you have to be listening very closely to what's going on. I think one of the most interesting things nowadays is that we're seeing the Occupy movement manifest, because you're dealing with social change now, we're seeing the Occupy movement manifest itself differently in different places. It's given rise to Trump. It's given rise to Saunders.
That's the first time I've heard somebody connect the Occupy movement with Trump.
Oh, yeah.
I think they'd be horrified.
But it's a general dissatisfaction.
Yes.
With the... elites and the power elites,
yep.
And the, you know, hogging all of the resources, the lack of upward mobility that's occurring in the U.S., and they're going in two directions.
The gap continues to grow, and we don't give a rat's ass about it.
Yeah.
Is what people are reacting against. Yeah, for sure.
Now, interestingly enough, if you look at Trump, Clinton, and Saunders, and look at the type of reaction they're making. Trump doesn't say anything logical. He doesn't, there's just nothing. There are no facts there. It doesn't matter. He could be the most illiterate person in the world, and it wouldn't matter because he makes an emotional connection.
Mm.
he's playing off of fear and doubt.
He's political clickbait.
Totally. Fear, doubt, and uncertainty.
Fear, doubt, and uncertainty.
You know, fear, uncertainty, FUD. So the FUD, well, I know there's a factor there somewhere. There's an acronym that I got. You know, on the other side of the coin, we've got Sanders, who is not only making an intellectual connection, and so he appeals to the intelligentsia, but he's making an emotional connection at the same time with the whole generation.
I think it's mostly to do with his hairdo. That's really what I think it is, or the fact
it's
that
good
he
hair.
Yeah, I'll never forget the first time I saw him was on the Jon Stewart was still at the helm at that Jon Stewart show, and that's kind of how they came in. Cheap laughs were over his hair, and just it was all over the place, and just so non-presidential this guy. Yeah. And to see where he's come is really remarkable.
Yeah, he's
got
a haircut.
It's encouraging, and it's that's right. He's bought a brush, and it's really affirming to me.
Yeah.
You know, wow, a guy with some different ideas standing on the outside can affect that kind of change, right?
Well, look at Canada in the last two elections. Mm. Leighton made an emotional connection.
Yes.
And Ignatieff, that's all huge pulsating brain in Ignatieff,
but
couldn't make an emotional connection with the voters. And so they swarmed towards Leighton because he actually was connecting. And then Leighton got replaced by Mulcair. And what sort of emotional connection is there?
Yeah.
Trudeau came along, and everybody sort of said, well, you know, maybe he's an intellectual lightweight, but he sure has a lot of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And he appeals on an emotional level. His father actually appealed on both levels.
On both levels,
which was a phenomenal. And you rarely get that. That's what people are looking for now. They're not looking for the intellect. Otherwise, Trump would, you know, we'd have Cruz there. Because Cruz is as much as I might hate anything that he says, he is a pulsating brain.
Right, right.
But doesn't matter.
It's interesting. I want to come back to that if we have time for it, because to me it seems like what you're really talking about there is, and maybe this is connected to the thought leadership question, but you had mentioned before offline that thought leadership is kind of dead before it's even really begun, this notion of it and this movement, I guess, if you want to call it that. Love to hear more about that. And is it connected to what you're saying here, this idea that we don't want the intellect? I don't want the facts anymore. I want story. I want you to connect with me personally, relationally.
Yeah.
Connect with me as a human being, and then maybe I'll buy your product, or maybe I'll change socially, or maybe I'll buy into the movement.
Well, a certain percentage of us deal logically and rationally and perhaps not emotionally, but it's a small percentage of people. And you know,
well, and it's not to say you can't do both, right?
No, true, but you know, you take a look at people who are scientifically trained, and the whole university environment doesn't train you to think emotionally. So if you look at the 20% of the people who are classically trained that way and ran the economy and ran the businesses and ran the networks and ran the media, you know, they were promulgating their view of the world, which is an intellectual and logical view of the world. And all of these people who are the creators of thought leadership have been disintermediated by YouTube and Twitter and the possibility to form a direct emotional connection with followers that bypasses the so-called intelligentsia.
Can you just quickly, before you go back to that, explain disintermediation? What does that mean exactly?
Well, we used
taken out of the equation, essentially?
We used to have the CBC, which would curate everything for
us.
And we had a series of curators. They existed in magazines and newspapers and TV and radio, and they were all the people with the degrees and all the ones that favored the intellect over the heart. And, you know, so they were the ones that controlled who got to see what in terms of any media
all
and who
news,
got to connect.
All the news that we think is fit to print.
Exactly, totally. So now that group has been bypassed, and so all of a sudden, these strange new ways of thinking are coming about because people are being influenced emotionally. Vaccination and the rise of the incredible increase in the people that aren't getting vaccinated, which is completely unscientifically based, is entirely based on the emotions and the connection that people have with a number of so-called emotional leaders or celebrities out in the marketplace. You know, that's the effect of this type of disintermediation.
So in other words, we don't need thought leaders because we can go dig it up for ourselves?
Don't stuff your thoughts down my throat again. You've been doing that for centuries. I don't care about what you think. I care about how I feel.
And that's care about how I feel, or about how you feel, or both?
Most people care about how they feel. So it's, I care about how I feel. And if you make me feel happy, if you make me feel safe, and you help deal with my fears, then I'm going to, I'm going
to
like
you. Is that connected at all, do you think, to sort of the, what I'm going to call affectionately, I think, the Google Office-like space movement? So open, get rid of those ugly banking barriers that people used to have in, on floor number 4, you wouldn't see any human faces, you'd just see these cloth walls, putting a ping pong table in the cafeteria, you can bring your dog to work. I mean, is this about appealing to people emotionally to make them better employees
I think that's more about saving money.
Right. Interesting. Yeah,
I've been in a few offices that are like that. I guess some people can work that way. I can't. I need no distractions. I need a barrier in front of me to work properly.
But well, I think, and I haven't read much of it, but I think there is some, there has been a few articles I've seen of late talking about maybe it's a little more limited than we thought, this idea of open office environments and, that whole relational, that you can see everybody kind of thing, because it is very distracting and people can't focus.
Yeah, I think it'd be nice to see them if you're standing, but when you're sitting, you shouldn't. That's just my opinion.
Right.
This isn't an area in which I've got much experience anyway.
So if thought leadership's moving to the side, does that mean something else will replace it? Does everybody become an expert then?
Yeah, but the funny thing is that it's not moving to the side. People are doing more and more, or trying to do more and more with thought leadership. It's a burgeoning industry.
Yeah.
But they're moving in the wrong direction when they try and make it more about intellect than emotion.
Interesting.
And the very successful marketers are the ones that can appeal to the, that can make an emotional appeal for ideas or for products or services or whatever you want. It's the I'd like to teach the world to sing concept. And keep it company. So if you look at that as a real departure and the creation of an emotional connection with a product, that's what successful
is.
Marketers
that why?
Are doing.
So I've heard crazy stats, and we're going to have to wrap this up sadly in a couple of minutes. But is this why so many businesses fail? Is this why I think 80% of all businesses in Canada fail? Maybe North America wide.
Well, 75% of startups fail, and 90% of new products fail, which is even more abysmal.
Holy smokes.
It really is. And the reason the new startups are a lower percentage is that there's a large percentage of service businesses there.
So does that mean my new paperclip's not going to take?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. I've been working on this for years.
Exactly. Most of the time, in fact, the greatest percentage of product failures comes from a lack of a market.
Hmm.
Because marketers and innovators don't understand the triggers and barriers that exist in the marketplace and don't understand how to differentiate themselves from the competition. And the really successful marketers are the ones who come up with radically different ideas that get over the barriers and appeal to triggers that are already existing. And instantaneous success happens. You don't see it very often with companies, but company like Uber is a great example of something that has connected with people in a way. Everybody's looking for taxis. People need transportation, and so the trigger already exists. And they took competition to a new level by competing on the basis of quality, cost, and speed all at the same time. Really highly differentiated from what was there. Not so much an emotional connection, but really different. Several ways of being really different. One of them is the emotional side, and one is through a product that is substantially, radically different.
Well, I mean, I think on some level, and I haven't used Uber, but from what little I've heard, I would think, my words, but they've made that experience more relational. I think they have, which is ironic based on the technology. I remember sitting on the train coming into Toronto and somebody sharing, here's how it works.
Yeah.
Oh, and they're great, by the way. And they're nice, and you don't have to tip because it's all included. I mean, it was all kind of about not just the transaction, but that relational component to it, which I thought was kind of interesting.
And when the driver's on the way, you actually get a picture of the driver.
Oh, so is that right?
You know what kind of car they're driving.
Wow.
You get a picture of the driver, the name of the driver.
You've humanized it a bit, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Sounds like you've got a few books in the making. I'd love to hear a little bit more about Material Minds as we wrap up. Can you talk to me about what's next? So you're researching, you're...
Well, I write a lot, but I write badly.
You're working on the Rocket Pack? Is
that
weird?
Exactly. And this is also back to this intellectual versus emotional connection, is that when you spend your life in business, you're trained to write like a business person. You try and write for a different audience, you can't write. My writing is dry and dense and turgid. And I'm lousy at it.
We won't quote you on that.
Yeah, I write a lot. I write very fast, but very poorly. So I'm trying to learn to write in a way that has a wider appeal. And what I'm writing about is these issues of triggers and barriers, how to differentiate yourself from the competition, dealing with issues like ambiguity. People really hate ambiguous.
Which frankly is why I think people don't want to change. There's a reason for not wanting to change.
And there are some marketers that are very good at resolving ambiguity.
Yeah, yeah.
And when they do, they knock down a few of the barriers. So it's very getting people to change is so complex.
Yeah.
And that's what, and in terms of ideas or in products, that's what successful people are able to do.
Book on the market anytime soon?
Oh, yeah, maybe in a year or so.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Good. So, well, listen, thanks so much for joining us today. Part two is, I hope, pending. Maybe
this was fun.
At the book release party.
Yeah.
I'll bring some wine.
Deal.
And you bring the books. Charles Plant, Material Minds, plural, materialminds.com. Check him out there online and look for his new book, soon to be released at your local Amazon.
Exactly.
Your digital bookstore. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.